it says that the U.S. selective removal of some entities from its sanctions list is not reviewed as a sign of goodwill. UN chief warns the G7 leaders' pledge of donating 1 billion COVID vaccines is insufficient to tackle the pandemic, as Oxfam says 11 billion jabs are needed. And Palestinians rally in Jerusalem Al-Quds in support of families facing Israel's eviction orders in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to World News. Iran has called on Washington to effectively and verifiably remove sanctions on Tehran, calling the U.S. so-called maximum pressure campaign a maximum failure. In a tweet, a foreign ministry spokesperson urged the U.S. President Joe Biden to stop following in his predecessor Donald Trump's footsteps. Saeed Khatibzadeh also said that Washington's recent move in lifting some sanctions has nothing to do with the Vienna talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, adding that selective delistings do not signal any goodwill in the face of what he called renewed U.S. economic terrorism. On Thursday, Washington repealed sanctions on 3 former Iranian officials and 2 companies, describing the move as a routine administrative action. Senior U.S. officials said the move was not related to the Vienna talks, but claimed it was Washington's good faith approach. Political commentator David Yahoubian says it's not a question of goodwill when it comes to the U.S. having breached U.N. Resolution 2231.
Quite simply, there is no goodwill. There is international law. The United States has maintained illegal sanctions against Iran and shown its animus towards the Iranian nation for decades. In the last 3 years, through its maximum pressure sanctions, not only has Iran lost up to $1 trillion in revenue, but Iranians have suffered and died as a result of this maximum pressure campaign, being denied critical medicines, especially at the height of a global pandemic. And so, you know, let's get real, as Medea Benjamin would say, there is no goodwill. There is international law. There is United Nations Resolution 2231, and there is the potential for a verifiable lifting of all sanctions, illegal sanctions against the Islamic Republic of Iran. And that is what the negotiators from the Iranian team are looking for in Vienna. And they're not looking for simply these supposed goodwill gestures, which I would have to agree. This is quite a step forward relative to what, you know, the Trump administration say would have done, which was right at the height of the meeting placed more sanctions. And so certainly it could be considered a step in the right direction, but there is no good faith. There is clearly delineated international law and the parameters of United Nations Resolution 2231 and the JCPOA, and the United States needs to return to compliance with international law and those parameters for the negotiations in Vienna to be successful, irrespective of things that it might do on the side to show its supposed goodwill.
Iran says it's regained voting rights of the UN General Assembly after its outstanding dues to the world body were paid. The announcement was made in a tweet by Iran's ambassador to the UN. Majid Takhtravanchi said illegal U.S. sanctions have not just deprived Iranians of medicine, but also prevented the country from paying its arrears to the UN. He called for immediate removal of all inhumane sanctions. UN spokesman Farhan Haq also confirmed Iran had paid the minimum amount needed to regain its voting rights. Iran had earlier proposed using its frozen assets in South Korea to pay off the dues. Iran was able to vote in the General Assembly on Friday to elect 5 new members of the UN Security Council. The UN Secretary General says G7 leaders' pledge of donating COVID vaccines is insufficient to tackle the pandemic. Antonio Guterres said the world needs more than 1 billion dose target the G7 is expected to share. He said the world is still far from adopting a global vaccination plan and dealing with the issue with a sense of urgency. International rights and charity groups, including Oxfam, have also criticized G7's vaccination agenda. Oxfam says the world needs 11 billion COVID jabs to defeat the pandemic. The charity organization also called on G7 leaders to support a push for waiving intellectual property rights behind the vaccines, a move which would allow more countries to produce the jabs. Joining us now from Shizu is Mr. Sijiro Takeshita, professor of management at the University of Shizuoka. Your thoughts on the G7 leaders' pledge of 1 billion doses and the fact that the UN is saying it's just simply not enough for the world to get this thing under control?
Well, it's a tug of war, actually, between the political issue and, of course, the health issue here, because obviously we know that what the G7 is trying to agree on is making sure that procurement is there, away from just-in-time into just-in-case, JIC. But behind it all, there is a very acute awareness about the upsurge of China. And basically, what G7 really want to do is secure the path of, you know, distribution of these medical issues without China being excessively involved. Because what China is doing is trying to utilize its position to enhance their force through this COVID-19 issue. So behind it all, I think we must clearly see the hegemony of war between the United States and China.
Really, so it's something that really shouldn't be politicized, you're saying, is deeply politicized, which is global vaccine distribution.
Oh, yeah, definitely, without a speck of doubt. But it's also totally understandable that we have to basically disperse the distribution and walking away from excessive inclination or excessive reliance to China, because they're the one who's trying to utilize, you know, their political force by using, you know, this pandemic as a tool. So basically, we have to be very, very careful, especially knowing what's going on with a human rights issue by the Chinese, and particularly, you know, the pressure that they're putting on Taiwan. We must all understand that, you know, this is a path that G7 nations have to be very careful about.
Right. And Professor, how do you address the fact that, you know, 54 countries in Africa are below 2% vaccination? And there's some parts of the world, it seems like, they're not even close to meeting even a tenth or a hundredth of their quotas to get vaccinated. And we all know that that's going to come back to bite even richer nations. How does that get addressed once you get beyond the politics of this?
You know, this is a typical prisoner's dilemma situation, you know, where we all have to cooperate. And if we all cooperate, things will get much better. We all know that, but we don't do that because we're all very selfish. Mm. A lot of it has to do with the very simple fact that, you know, a lot of countries have the pharmaceutical companies which have spent so much money in developing these things, and obviously they want to retrieve, you know, that fund. And there is no assurance that, you know, these African nations will be able to pay off later on. So this is very, very dire situation of prince's dilemma. I think it's a typical case where, again, you know, the profits and the payment, the monetary issue, the economic issue is entangled with the human, you know, issue as well.
Okay, so if we put greed next to politics, do you think ultimately it'll come back to, and do you think that ultimately we'll get to the point where a lot of, you know, people, specialists, are really concerned that this thing, because we don't get it under control, evolves and there's new strains of it that don't basically respond to the Pfizers and the Modernas and the AstraZenecas and the Sinovacs and the Sinopharms and the Sputnik Vs?
Well, I think it would be unfortunate if such would become the case, and there is all the possibility of that happening. I cannot, you know, basically strike that off as a as an impossible issue, because it is very, very possible that that could happen. Then again, I think this is where people have to realize and negotiate, you know, some kind of a deal to basically sustain the positive part of the prisoner's dilemma. In other words, where we can all cooperate, where we can basically mingle the economic, the profit issues with the benefits and also the healthcare side. We have to get into negotiation. We can't just talk about human rights or else, you know, the countries who have those pharmaceutical companies will never give a positive nod.
Thank you, Professor, for joining us. Stay safe. That was a Professor Sijiro Takeshita, Professor of Management at the University of Shizuoka, joining us from Shizuoka. Now, Palestinians have rallied in Jerusalem Al-Quds in support of families in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood who face eviction orders from the Israeli regime.
presence in Sheikh Jarrah today is a position of support and backing for our people in Sheikh Jarrah and also in Jerusalem, because the battle for survival is our battle for all. We are here to say that we are part of this battle, together in Jerusalem until liberation.
The protesters have voiced their full support for the people of Sheikh Jarrah and are demanding justice for them. Four Palestinian families in the neighborhood face imminent forced expulsion under Israel's continued land grab policy as part of the regime's illegal settlement activity. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has already warned Israel against the Judaization of Al-Quds and the eviction of Sheikh Jarrah residents. Palestinian Red Crescent says Israeli troops have killed a Palestinian teenager during a protest in the occupied West Bank. Fifteen-year-old Mohammed Saeed was shot dead in the village of Beita, south of Nablus. At least 110 protesters were also injured as Israeli troops fired live rounds and tear gas at the demonstrators. Ralliers had gathered in Beita to voice anger at the construction of new settler units near the village. They set fire to tires and hurled stones at Israeli forces. Tensions have been running high in the occupied territories for months over Israel's settlement activities, as well as the regime's planned eviction of Palestinian families from their homes. All Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. Political commentator Paul Larudi says that the international community remains silent on Israel's atrocities against Palestinians.
Basically, the occupying regime, the Israeli occupiers, are giving room for as little recourse as possible. They don't want the Palestinians to defend their rights. They want to give them as little possibility of defending their rights as possible. There's some recourse to international bodies but international bodies don't really stop the Israelis. The Israelis don't abide by any international laws or decisions, and so they're doing this. They're handling it their way, and their way is violence. And they feel that the only way they can stop Palestinians from defending their rights is to harm them and often kill them.
Pakistan's ruling party has faced tough resistance from government employees as well as combined opposition parties after it announced its annual budget. Now, the opposition has vowed to block the passage of the budget in parliament, calling it an IMF agenda, which is aimed at further accelerating price hikes and inflation in the country.
Pakistan has announced a $55 billion US dollar annual budget. The country's opposition parties attempted to block the proceedings of the budget, calling it an IMF dictated budget and burden on the poor people.
We have come up with budget which would focus on the welfare of every segment of the society. From 1st July, all government employees would be provided 10% ad hoc increase in their salaries.
However, no one among these protesters outside the parliament in the federal capital were willing to trust the government, which linked a controversial bailout package with the IMF about 3 years ago. Under IMF pressure, Pakistan significantly devalued its currency, raised interest rate, and increased tax rates, which led to massive price hike, inflation, and brought down the growth rate.
The government is scared of IMF, and the government and its ministers are helpless. They had agreement with us to provide us a reduced share in the budget, but they are coming up with a budget which will hit hard the poor people.
Just few months back, these were the scenes near the parliament when the protesters forced the ruling party to ink an agreement with them to provide substantial increase to hundreds of thousands of the government employees. However, now they feel betrayed after government only provided them of what they called an insignificant raise in their salaries. Few weeks ago, Prime Minister Imran Khan sacked his finance minister for towing IMF agenda. Nonetheless, the economic problems are far from over. Pakistan's economy begins to recover with more revenue and more remittances. However, the government is failing to provide relief to the common people suffering from rising unemployment and extraordinary surge in their utility bills. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Spanish women stage protests throughout the country against male violence in the wake of recent killings of women. Women dressed in black lit candles to protest the recent cases of femicide. This came after a rescuers found the body of one of two girls recently gone missing in the Canary Islands. Father of the missing girls, Thomas G., is the main suspect in the disappearance of six-year-old Olivia and one-year-old Anna. He failed to return the girls to their mother as agreed at the end of April. He is also missing. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Beijing wants the U.S. and the West to know that its coming legal retaliation against perceived as unjust sanctions is supported by its people, says Jeff Powell, journalist, in an article titled China to Fire Back at U.S. Sanctions. Stay tuned for more. China will soon pass a law to strike back against the countries that have imposed sanctions on Chinese state organs, enterprises, organizations, and functionaries, including those with links to the People's Liberation Army. New draft legislation dubbed the Anti-Foreign Sanctions Law was submitted to the National People's Congress, NPC, Standing Committee for a second reading recently. It is expected that the draft will be approved by the top legislative body in China soon. The details of the draft have not been made public. However, according to a Xinhua report, the Chinese government will launch multiple corresponding countermeasures against entities and individuals in relevant countries, meaning the United States, from the beginning of 2021. During the two sessions in early March, some members of the NPC and Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, CPPCC, suggested it was necessary for China to formulate a specific law to counter foreign sanctions. Members of the NPC Standing Committee reviewed the draft for the first time in a meeting in late April and broadly agreed to formulate the law to counter foreign sanctions. They also gave some advice and suggestions on improving the draft, Xinhua reported. For some time, out of political manipulation needs and ideological bias, some Western countries have used Xinjiang and Hong Kong-related issues as part of their pretext to spread rumors on and smear, contain and suppress China. According to the spokesperson office of the Legislative Affairs Commission of the NPC Standing Committee. In particular, the countries in violation of international law and the basic norms governing international relations have imposed so-called sanctions on relevant Chinese state organs, organizations, and functionaries in accordance with their domestic laws, grossly interfering in China's internal affairs, added the spokesperson. The office said China would use the new law to safeguard national sovereignty, dignity, and core interests, and oppose Western hegemonism and power politics. Last July, then-U.S. President Donald Trump issued an executive order to end Hong Kong's special status with the U.S. and signed into law a bill to impose sanctions on a dozen Hong Kong and Chinese officials, including Chief Executive Carrie Lam. It was reported that some banks had canceled Lam's accounts, forcing the Hong Kong leader to keep her money in cash at home. Lam said it was a tad inconvenient using only cash, but it was an honor for her to be able to safeguard national security. Last December, the Trump administration sanctioned 14 vice chairmen of the NPC over their role in Beijing tightening its grip on Hong Kong and in setting policies for Xinjiang. Beijing later imposed sanctions of its own, targeting some U.S. officials and congressmen. Ahead of a meeting between the U.S. and China's top officials in Alaska in March, the Biden administration announced it would sanction more Chinese officials. In the same month, Guo Shiqing, chairman of the China Banking and Insurance Regulatory Commission, said all financial institutions in Hong Kong would not implement the U.S. sanctions but had to enforce Chinese laws and regulations. Charles Ho Tsu Kwok, a Hong Kong businessman and one of the 18 members of the CPPCC Standing Committee, said in an interview with Hong Kong's commercial radio recently that Chief Executive Lam should be blamed for lacking knowledge, experience, and vision when handling the anti-extradition saga in 2019. Citing the comment made by the then Chinese ambassador to the United Kingdom, Liu Xiuming, in June 2019, Ho said it was Lam's idea instead of Beijing's order to launch the extradition law legislation. Ho said he had warned Lam that such a move would lead to foreign sanctions, but she refused to listen to his advice. Ho said although Lam was also sanctioned by the U.S., her personal loss was insignificant when compared to that of the business sector, which lost a lot of trade benefits after U.S. revoked Hong Kong's special status last year. Lam said people enjoyed the right to comment on the government and its governance as Hong Kong was a place with freedom of speech. She said she and her team would continue to listen to people's advice in a humble manner and try their best to finish the tasks within the last year of her current term. the two sessions in March, the NPC Standing Committee said its main tasks in the coming year included enriching the legal toolkit with a focus on moves against sanctions and interference and countering long-arm jurisdiction to cope with challenges and risks. Deng Yuwen, a U.S.-based Chinese scholar and a researcher at the China Strategic Analysis Center, told RTHK that it seemed to be lacking legitimacy when the Chinese government counteracted foreign sanctions with diplomatic means in the past. Deng said the launch of the anti-foreign sanctions law would increase the legitimacy of Chinese sanctions and also send a message to the West that China's retaliation against foreign sanctions was supported by the Chinese people. However, Deng said the new law would not make much difference in real practice. Wu Qiang, a Beijing-based independent political commentator, said the launch of anti-foreign sanctions law was aimed at retaliating against U.S. sanctions imposed on 14 vice chairmen of the NPC and to show Chinese President Xi Jinping's fighting spirit. Wu said after the law was passed, China would impose sanctions on foreign people, companies, and governments whenever it faced foreign sanctions. He said some foreign trade and cooperation partnerships would be affected.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of Back to Reality here on IRIB English Radio. In the studio with me, I have my brothers in faith and humanity, Brother Mudaffa, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Brother Hassanain, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
We have been blessed with the tawfiq and the gift
alhamdulillah
to live in the city of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim assalam and to be the guest of the daughter of the Messenger of Allah, Sayyidina Ma'asumah salamullah alayha. I want you guys to take me down memory lane.
Memory lane.
Yeah, for today's episode. Okay, I want to keep it really nice, really homey, really personal, and your experience, first time you came to Qom. How many years ago? How did it happen? How did it go down?
You asking me first?
I'm asking you first.
I don't remember. It was around 7 years back. It's all very fuzzy for me. I'm sorry. I would take you down memory road if I could. Forget about memory lane. I would take you down memory road, the highway of memories. But I honestly don't remember. It's all fuzzy and brother.
Brother Hassanain, please help like me out.
It was like 2 years back when I came to Qom first. To live in the city of Qom to study. But I came to Qom for Ziyarat before that, those years as well. So if you talk about, you know, me visiting the Holy Shrine for the first time. So in fact, not just the first time, it's like this feeling I have every time I visit the Holy Shrine of Hazrat Ma'asumah salamullah alayha. So, you know, I have the feeling that I'm visiting my mother. There's a feeling that I get every time, not just the first time.
That's beautiful.
Okay, so, and there's one reason for that. Because we usually visit the different shrines of the, you know, different holy imams.
Yeah.
So all of them are men, they're imams. And so alhamdulillah, I've been blessed that they have visited almost all of the holy shrines. Mm. But unfortunately, I haven't been to Syria. So I have visited all the holy shrines. And unfortunately, we don't have a holy shrine for Hazrat Fatima Salam Alayha. So I even went to Medina, but there's no shrine for Bibi Salam Alayha. So, but when I came to Qum, so it was the first holy shrine of a lady, holy lady.
Beautiful.
So now I feel like, you know, I'm visiting my mother.
Oh, that is
you know,
so
and
sweet.
She's actually our, you know, true mother.
She is.
So
she really is.
I get that feeling and, you know, I just feel like, you know, sitting there for hours and, you know, conversing with her, like sharing my, you know, how my day went, like everything.
That's
that
so
is really
cute.
Cute, mashallah.
معصوم ملیکه ارض و سمایی یا معصوم شفیع روز جزایی یا معصوم تو زینب امام رضایی یا معصوم ملیکه ارض و سمایی یا معصوم شفیع روز جزایی یا تو زینب امام رضایی.
Brother Muzaffar,
yo.
I'm sure you had such like a similar experience. Okay, fine, you don't remember the first time you went to her shrine. Tell me about the most memorable visit.
My journey has been a little bit different because...
Tell me about your different journey.
It's a bit controversial, right? I am always envious of brothers like Hasanain, right?
Right.
I feel very envious, especially when everybody who I talk to, they have the same or a similar experience of different great abilities. But for me, I visited the shrine and it was just... I felt blank. It was just like, okay,
you were overwhelmed.
This is a shrine, okay... people here. No, I wasn't even overwhelmed.
Was this your first time?
First time, second time, maybe the first 10 times, you know, for the first year or two or three, I was a strange person. I still am. I think I've become stranger. No, but, you know, people's upbringing has a role to play in how they come into this weird world and this dunya of this, you know, I've had a bad past. I've had a bad life, guys. All right. I went to a really bad school. It's just been bad.
Bad.
All right. But anyway, that's how I felt. Okay. And I've always craved to understand what the ziyara actually means.
Right.
At the end of the day, you're going and visiting a grave. This is a person who is buried here.
So, like, was it your first time visiting any holy shrine?
No. Funnily enough, my first... ever ziyara was to Syria to Sayyidah Zainab. So
I haven't been
always
there.
Oh. Always felt a very deep connection to Sayyidah Zainab. You know more about Sayyidah Zainab.
True.
You know, you've always you
right.
know about her story.
True.
You know about her journey. Sayyidah Zainab has always been a humongous hero for me. You know, she's Sayyidah Zainab. She was there in Karbala. She stood up in Sham. She spoke out against the tyrant. She was in the court of Yazid and she spoke with the eloquence of her father, you know, all of that. So that was a different experience. Sayyidah Ma'asuma, she's the sister of Imam Rida alayhi salam. So they had other sisters, they had other brothers, you know, they had many, many siblings and aunties and uncles. And so why is that special? You know, so for the longest time, and I am very ashamed to say this, but at the same time, I'm just being honest. This is how I felt. I did not understand the concept of tawassul. It took me a long time to get over that hurdle. My goodness. And I didn't understand this idea of the Ahlul Bayt hearing us even though they've passed on from this dunya. Okay? So yeah, that's where I was and that was what my general experience was.
How long have you been living in her city, Brother Hasan?
2 years.
2 years. How do you feel she's contributed to your life during your time here?
Okay, so, you know, in my daily life, you know, when I came to Qom, you know, my life changed completely. Like, you know, when you live in the city of Qom, it has got a, you know, different environment. You know, visiting the holy shrine, you know, every time I visit the holy shrine, like, it literally purifies my soul. So, living in Qom, I got more heedful of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a thing, you know, there's a thing we all need in our life. You know, as Imam Ali says in his sermon in Nahj al-Balagha, that how can you not be heedless of he who is not heedless of you?
Beautiful.
So, like, living in the holy city of Qom and visiting the holy shrine, you know, I've got more closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and got heedless to him.
Which is really such a valuable blessing. It's not very often that we find ourselves in a point in life that we feel like I'm more God conscious now.
Alhamdulillah.
Right? And yeah, I think you've been really blessed. At such a young age, too, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
What did you want to say?
And one more point I wanted to mention, that, you know, like, okay, so we are living here as foreigners, so, like, we don't have a family over here. It's just, like, few friends.
Right.
So the thing is, you
don't... I don't even have any friends.
May Allah bless you with tons of friends.
She doesn't want
any. I don't want any friends.
Take it back.
Okay, please continue.
Okay, so the thing is, like me living alone here, so... But I have always got that in my mind that, you know, I have someone over here, and that's my mother, Sayyida Fatima. So it's like whenever you're sad or you're going through difficulties or, you know, hard times, you have someone to share your problems with.
Mm.
And, you know, sharing your problems with Ahlul Bayt and especially the Imam is the man of your time. You know, it relaxes your heart.
It really does.
Yeah, so that's the best thing of living in Qom. Like, you go through any problem, like, it shouldn't be like this. Like, we just go there to, you know, solve our problems. We should go there because we love them. But this is the one good thing, that whenever we are in problems, we can go and talk to them. Like, we can share our problems with them, and we can do tawassul.
Even if your problems don't immediately get resolved, you don't feel that sense of impending doom. You're all alone. It's you against the world anymore. You feel like, you're like, I've got backup. So, Brother Mudhafa, all right, so obviously your first experience sucked, but it's, I understand that. It's because of the place we were from. It was a horrible place.
No, I guess it's because of the reason, you know, recognizing someone. Like, if you take me to a holy shrine, I don't know who it is. Okay, so it's a grave. And
naturally,
people come and visit
naturally.
It. So it's about recognizing.
Tell me about your journey from feeling nothing at her shrine, because I was like, you were like, who are you? To now going to her shrine, how does it feel today?
Now I've developed that connection, I think, to a certain extent.
To a certain extent, exactly.
I understand that when you go to the shrine, she is hearing you. I understand that her status is very, very high.
Why? Tell me, what is it about her status that's high? Status. I never say status, okay?
Yeah, that's the American accent.
What is it about her status?
Her status, basically it's, I could only arrive at that through trusting Allah and the Ahlul Bayt. I had to develop that trust in order to get there. We already knew things, like, for example, one who visits my sister, Imam Ridha alayhi salam said that, you know, falahul jannah.
So paradise is obligatory upon he who visits my
jannah
sister.
Jannah is his, okay? Then I had to develop...
Because it sounds so far-fetched.
It's like, why? Look at that guy. Look at that lady over there. She's not even wearing proper hijab or... I don't know. Like, you judge people, right? Why should these people go to Jannah just because they paid for a ticket and they came from, I don't know, Singapore, and they came over here and they went... they put some flowers on the shrine or whatever and they left. He's getting Jannah now. He's getting Jannah. All right, so this always stood out to me.
I feel you.
I'm being completely frank, right?
I know, I appreciate it.
So I'm like, no, I don't believe this. So then it took me a while to understand and to learn to trust what the Ahlul Bayt are saying and what the Prophet and Allah is saying. When I developed that trust and then I looked at these things, then I started to understand that it requires too much information in order to do that. It's better to and wiser, actually, to just trust what they are saying. Imam Khomeini would spend a lot of time in the shrine. some
so
people,
many of our ulama, yeah, ulama Tabatabai,
they would actually spend a significant amount of time. So they came to him and they said, hey, you know, you're a mudja, you should be doing other things, you know, why are you sitting by her? He said, if you knew who she is, you wouldn't say that.
That's exactly what I wanted to say. And I think Brother Hassanain alluded to it at some point too. It's our lack of knowledge. We don't have ma'rifah. We don't have enough ma'rifah toward her to understand. And I think by that hadith, Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam means you visit her arifan bihaqqaha, while you have ma'rifah toward her position, toward who she is, the essence of her existence, then you're going to be in heaven, man, because you're already a very, like...
Now, the feminine question comes into this. The feminine question comes into it, because when it comes to women in the world of Islam, in the history of Islam, I feel like there is a very two-dimensional way that we seem to look at women. Sayyida Ma'asuma, for me, she opened my eyes to a certain extent to help me to understand Sayyida Fatima al-Zahra. Sayyida Zainab always stood out to me. Sayyida Zainab was that heroic figure. She stood against the Taghut. She did those kinds of things. She was in Karbala. Sayyida Fatima, though, although she did do that as well, and she had the same eloquence, etc., generally speaking, she's seen as a woman of the household. Okay? You know, most of the riwayat that we have about her, about being in the household, cooking, cleaning,
raising her children. Doing ibadah.
So it took me a long time to understand that Allah places value in things which please Him.
By the right of Sayyidina Ma'asuma herself, Allah blesses you with the tawfiq to visit her shrine and pour your heart and soul out to her in the near future.
Inshallah.
Until then, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, Letti Umma Raizaka. يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي التي أمى رائزك لتصي دليلتك وانسك
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's policies to check China's trade dominance are not going away anytime soon. This is one of the few issues on which Democrats and Republicans broadly agree, and there is little question that trade deglobalization undermines the U.S. dollar. Here we present you an article written by Kenneth Rogoff, professor of economics and public policy at Harvard University. The piece is titled, "The U.S. Dollar's Hegemony is Looking Fragile." The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. The U.S. dollar's dominance may well be more fragile than it appears, because expected future changes in China's exchange rate regime are likely to trigger a significant shift in the international monetary order. For many reasons, the Chinese authorities will probably someday stop pegging their renminbi to a basket of currencies and shift to a modern inflation-targeting regime under which they allow the exchange rate to fluctuate much more freely, especially against the U.S. dollar. When that happens, expect most of Asia to follow China. In due time, the dollar, currently the anchor currency for roughly two-thirds of the world's gross domestic product or GDP, could lose nearly half of its weight. Considering how much the United States relies on the dollar's special status, or what then French Finance Minister Valéry Giscard d'Estaing famously called America's exorbitant privilege, to fund massive public and private borrowing, the impact of such a shift could be significant. Given that the United States has been aggressively using deficit financing to combat the economic ravages of COVID-19, the sustainability of its debt might be called into question. The long-standing argument for a more flexible Chinese currency is that China is simply too big to let its economy dance to the U.S. Federal Reserve's tune, even if Chinese capital controls provide some measure of insulation. China's gross domestic product, or GDP, measured at international prices, surpassed that of the United States back in 2014, and is still growing far faster than that of the United States and Europe, making the case for greater exchange rate flexibility increasingly compelling. A more recent argument is that the U.S. dollar's centrality gives the United States government too much access to global transactions information. This is also a major concern in Europe. In principle, dollar transactions could be cleared anywhere in the world, but U.S. banks and clearing houses have a significant natural advantage, because they can be implicitly or explicitly backed by the U.S. Federal Reserve, which has unlimited capacity to issue currency in a crisis. In comparison, any dollar clearing house outside the United States will always be more subject to crises of confidence, a problem with which even the Eurozone has struggled. Moreover, former U.S. President Donald Trump's policies to check China's trade dominance are not going away anytime soon. This is one of the few issues on which both Democrats and Republicans broadly agree, and there is little question that trade deglobalization undermines the U.S. dollar. Chinese policymakers face many obstacles in trying to break away from the current renminbi peg, but in characteristic style, they have slowly been laying the groundwork on many fronts. China has been gradually allowing foreign institutional investors to buy renminbi bonds, and in 2016, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, added the renminbi to to the basket of major currencies that determines the value of special drawing rights, the IMF's global reserve asset. In addition, the People's Bank of China is far ahead of other major central banks in developing a central bank digital currency. Although currently purely for domestic use, the PBOC's, the People's Bank of China's digital currency, ultimately will facilitate the renminbi's international use, especially in countries that gravitate towards China's eventual currency bloc. This will give the Chinese government a window into digital renminbi users' transactions, just as the current system gives the United States a deal of similar information. Will other Asian countries indeed follow China? The United States will certainly push hard to keep as many economies as possible orbiting around the US dollar, but it will be an uphill struggle. Just as the US eclipsed Britain at the end of the 19th century as the world's largest trading country, China long ago surpassed America by the same measure. True, Japan and India may go their own way, but if China makes the renminbi more flexible, they will likely, at the very least, give the currency a weight comparable to that of the US dollar in their foreign exchange reserves. There are striking parallels between Asia's close alignment with the US dollar today and the situation in Europe in the 1960s and the early 1970s. But that era ended with high inflation and the collapse of the post-war Bretton Woods Agreement, the system of fixed exchange rates. Most of Europe then recognized that intra-European trade was more important than trade with the United States. This led to the emergence of a Deutschmark bloc that decades later morphed into the single currency, the euro. This does not mean that the Chinese renminbi will become the global currency overnight. Transitions from one dominant currency to another can take a long time. For example, during the two decades between the First and the Second World Wars, the new entrant, the US dollar, had roughly the same weight in central bank reserves as the British pound, which had been the dominant global currency for more than a century following the Napoleonic Wars in the early 1800s. So what is wrong with the three world currencies? The euro, the renminbi, and the dollar, sharing the spotlight. Nothing, except that neither markets nor policymakers seem remotely prepared for such a transition. US government borrowing rates would almost certainly be affected, though the really big impact might fall on corporate borrowers, especially small and medium-sized firms. Today it seems to be an article of faith among US policymakers and many economists that the world's appetite for the US dollar debt is virtually insatiable. But a modernization of China's exchange rate arrangements could deal the US dollar status a painful blow. Senior Russian diplomat says more countries around the world are joining an initiative to use local currencies for settlement of trade payments, as the US dollar becomes increasingly unreliable because of Washington's sanction policies. In remarks published on Monday, 5th of April, Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Pankin said countries in the Asia-Pacific region, including China and Japan, as well as others in Africa and Latin America, have become interested in Moscow's proposal to use non-dollar and local currencies for payment settlements. Alexander Pankin was quoted as saying by the Sputnik news agency, "Russia is developing enhanced cooperation on the matter with its partners from the Asia-Pacific region, where the readiness to switch to mutual settlements in national currencies or other currencies apart from the US dollar is quite high." He added that Moscow has been involved in efforts to synchronize its national payment systems with those of China and Japan to facilitate the removal of the US dollar from trade settlements. The Russian Deputy Foreign Minister said that switching to non-dollar payments could be implemented in settlements between members of blocs in Eurasia regions, including the EAEU and the CIS. Alexander Pankin said Moscow has been engaged in talks with other major economic and trade blocs around the world, including the BRICS, to promote the issue. Russia has been subject to a series of inclusive American and European sanctions since 2014, when a series of political developments in neighboring Ukraine led to the fall of a pro-Russian government in Kiev. However, Moscow has sought to use the sanctions as an opportunity to distance itself from the U.S. dollar system to minimize the economic impact of the U.S. bans. Russia's central bank has also reduced the share of the greenback in its reserves, by switching to other currencies like the euro and the Chinese yuan, or to gold. Russia has already removed the US dollar from dealings with allied countries, including with China and with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Alexander Pankin said central banks in Russia and partner countries, including in the Islamic Republic of Iran, have stepped up efforts to synchronize their financial messaging systems to develop an alternative to the dollar-based SWIFT, a Europe-based clearinghouse for international payments which is highly sensitive to Washington's sanction policies. China's economy has become so big that the Chinese authorities have no option but to distance themselves from the U.S. dollar system. He said the dollar would further collapse once other major economies in Asia, including Japan and India, follow China and give the yuan a weight comparable to that of the U.S. dollar in their foreign exchange reserves. China's ongoing efforts to introduce a digital yuan would further facilitate the currency's international use and would allow China to assume a position like the United States to regulate and monitor global transactions. China's foreign exchange policies in recent years have been a major headache for the United States financial system, whilst Beijing's continuous economic growth has enabled many partner countries to ditch the U.S. dollar from their trade with the rest of the world. China is quickly expanding its economic influence around the world through building new partnerships with other countries.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.